This is Playback Daily for Thursday, the 12th of August. I'm Gemma Craddock, and today we have this.
Perfection is the enemy of the good. If you want this to be perfect and you're going in, nobody's going to have a grumpy face. Nobody's going to be on their devices. We're going to have the most wonderful, you know, Brady Bunch family you've ever seen. It's not going to work that way.
And some of this.
He had a heartbeat sent to him on his WhatsApp from one of the doctors from the Rotunda that sent it to his phone, and he played it to me and he said, well, if you're not pregnant, whose heartbeat is on the phone?
And even a little of this.
You know, I was with one client this morning. She turned 87 last week. So, and she does a practice. Every day she'll do her own practice and we see each other once a week. And she has, there's a quality of a spring chicken in her.
So sit back and relax as I take you through selected highlights from the day on Radio 1. Now let's start with fatbergs and shopping sprees. Catherine Thomas, sitting in for Ray Darcy, shared some of the news stories that caught her attention.
Leaving your phone in the hands of your children can be a dangerous mistake. Most of us do it from time to time, hand over the phone so you can, I don't know, go to the loo in peace or do your Zoom call or whatever and let your child watch a cartoon or look at photos. The last thing we expect them to do is to clock up a bill of €1,000 on a shopping spree. But that is what happened to poor Antrim mom Hayley Carlisle, who was in the bathroom having a shower while six-year-old Aria was happily buying up a storm on Amazon. What did she put into the shopping cart? Lots of toys, obvs, a £400 Google Pixel phone, a climbing frame for the family cat. I want to know how much that was. Makeup, she bought clothes and lots of pairs of shoes, which, fair play to her, she hadn't, she managed to get in her own size. She's six. This child is six. I think whatever happens, you need to like let her keep at least one of those pairs of shoes. But anyway, poor Hayley, her mom came out of the bathroom and saw all the text notifications. And as you would, she presumed that she'd been a victim of fraud, but soon realised the culprit was closer to home. She said, I looked on my bank app and saw it was all coming from Amazon. So I quickly checked and realised it wasn't a scammer, just my six-year-old having a treat yourself Tuesday. So, but you know what? I feel for poor little Aria, because if you've ever bought anything on Amazon, you'll know they actually make it so easy. Like it's too easy sometimes, because you press purchase thinking that you have to put your card details in. But once you're signed up, you don't have to do that step, is no longer required. It's simply the click of a button. So I'm sure there are plenty of stories out there of unwanted purchases. Anyway, that made me laugh today. I don't know whether it should or not. But a good news story is in relation to the huge response to the UNICEF Get a Vaccine, Give a Vaccine campaign. You would have heard Liam Neeson doing the voiceover on radio for the last couple of months. And yet again, it's phenomenal, lads. Irish citizens and businesses have outdone themselves. They've donated more than 1 million COVID vaccines to poorer countries, raising 2.5 million since it was launched in June. And Executive Director of UNICEF Ireland, Peter Power, he's all over the papers today and online, basically saying, you know, he is blown away by the response. They didn't expect it. And, you know, I think it is such a brilliant campaign because it is so simple and makes so much sense. Even the 15 minutes you're sitting in the chair waiting after your vaccine, it's the opportunity. It's when we all think about, you know, we've been given this choice when so many other people around the world have not. So I just thought that was great reading today, and fair play to everybody who's donated so far. What else? Yes, a giant fatberg is blocking sewers under Belfast City. If you are eating your lunch or having your coffee and cake, maybe put it down, because fatbergs, they're disgusting. I mean, there's no other way of describing them. They're basically a build-up of fats and oil and grease, and when they cool, they congeal into these big giant blockages, and you know, and then you add nappies or wipes or everything else in on top of it. And it's just, it jams the pipes. And Northern Ireland Water are reminding people, only flush the three P's, paper, poo and pee. Everything else needs to be binned. And it's a big problem. We're hearing about them more and more. I know it's disgusting, but particularly in parts of the cities and in areas where lots of pubs and restaurants and takeaways are. The largest ever fatberg was discovered in Liverpool in 2019, weighing 400 tonnes, measuring 250 metres long. That's bigger than an airplane. And the congealed mess was so bad that engineers had to hack away using pickaxes, and it took around 6 weeks to break up. I mean, if you're thinking you're having a bad day in work today, imagine doing 6 weeks of that. I mean, I don't know.
Anyway, from something stomach churning in the sewers of Belfast to something of questionable taste on the streets above, Paul O'Connella told Catherine about a novel new Airbnb listing. You can now stay in George Best's childhood home, which has undergone a transformation.
It's not your typical renovation. They're calling it a retro refurbishment. And I was wondering what that meant. I took a good look. And what it means is basically when you walk into the house today, you're walking into 1961.
Wow.
And in that was the year when a 15-year-old George Best would have left East Belfast to go off to follow his dreams in Manchester. Of course, we all know what happened after that. But the house kind of, I suppose, is frozen in time in a sense. It's where his mum and dad lived. Right into, I think it was 2008, his dad died. And it has been owned by the regeneration charity called Eastside Partnership. And basically, they have fitted it out to look exactly as it was then. So you're talking about mad wallpapers, frilly bed sheets, tiny fireplaces covered in tiles. You know, there's pictures on the walls from the era. There's a tiny old CRT-style tube telly. And you can even flick through family photo albums and things like that. So for anyone sort of a fan of George Best, the pop cultural and football icon, there's a place to stay with a difference.
Yeah, I'm just looking at images of it now online. It's pretty out there. And they'd be all unique pieces. Like they'd be all original pieces or not.
Yeah, I think so. Somewhere there is a design studio in South Dublin looking at this and going to transform it into a pub interior. It looks kind of like unwittingly hipster or something, doesn't it, when you look at
it's
it?
It's like you've got your
tasseled lampshades and everything.
Frilly lampshades, your orange wallpaper, but even the old storage heaters, they look pretty good as well. But I mean,
they do. And
go ahead.
It's a good news story, I think, for East Belfast. This isn't a part of the city many people will be familiar with. And I certainly wasn't, but I visited recently. And they have, bit by bit, this place is transforming. There's a beautiful new build visitor centre there telling the story of the area, Harlan and Wolff nearby, which obviously is where the Titanic was built. Mm. Another person who was born and grew up locally is C.S. Lewis. And there is a square called C.S. Lewis Square that's been completely transformed. It's got giant sculptures based on The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. So you can see this enormous metal sculpture of Aslan the Lion, and then there's the Ice Queen and Mr. Tumnus the Fawn and all that. So I just think in terms of regenerating an inner city neighbourhood, it's a lovely good news story for Belfast, which, as you quite rightly say, we often tend to think of in terms of negative stories.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, George Best, he's such an icon and, you know, for so many people, so many football fans, like, that would be of huge interest. I'd love to go just for the interiors, but, you know, in terms of a fan, to go and, you know, sleep in the room and you know, retrace his steps before he went off and became, you know, one of the most famous footballers in the world. It's kind of cool. How much is it to stay there, Paul?
Well, what would you have said before I told you? I don't know if you've seen the price. Guess. It's the full house.
It's the full house. So how many rooms? Two rooms?
Three rooms.
Three rooms. Oh, 200? 250? 200?
Yeah, you're not too far. It's actually a bit cheaper. 150 euro. Basically, so with per night. So I thought that was a bit of a steal.
It is really good value considering the sort of the celebrity kudos that comes with it.
Yeah, exactly. You can get it on Airbnb if any of your listeners are interested. But yeah, and it's real, I suppose, an exercise in nostalgia more than anything, isn't it? If you want a swanky 5-star creature comforts in Belfast, maybe take a good look at the pictures first.
And since we're on the topic of celebrity footballers, former Irish and Manchester United star Roy Keane is known for being fairly intransigent, so is it any surprise that yoga proved to be a challenge? Keane has said in the media that yoga practice resulted in his worst ever performance while playing with Man United. Yoga and meditation instructor Michael Ryan, responsible for Uachtaráin na hÉireann's impressive downward dog, weighed in with Phil about your haze.
One of the things that yoga is designed to do is to create balance. It's about bringing things into equilibrium, bringing things into a kind of a healthy place. And sometimes when we're on that track toward balance, it requires us to kind of pause or stop or rest. So quite often I see this a lot in clients that come to me and we do a yoga practice and they'd be wiped after it because there was this residual tiredness that was just being pushed down and it wasn't being addressed and wasn't being looked at. Now, that's the stuff that if we don't deal with it, it becomes chronic illness. So, you know, what I would, for me, what it seems that happened is that there was this tiredness. And of course, Roy Keane, you know, he lived a very high-powered, go, productive lifestyle. There's a lot of demand. And that's going to have a taxing effect on the nervous system. You need to down-regulate. You need to learn how to rest. And a lot of us in our society just don't know how to rest because it's all about being productive, getting out there, doing.
That's very interesting. So do most or do many first-time yoga practitioners end up having that experience that they're just knackered at the end of it?
Well, it depends on how they're doing before they start. So, you know, and look, and it wouldn't be like it's true that in our society, again, a lot of people who would end up coming to me and quite often, you know, yoga is more and more seen as a kind of a normal thing. And actually, Roy Keane's statements in the past have been very complimentary towards yoga. He's talked about it as extending his career. So he's said other things since that comment that came out that have been very positive about yoga. And he continued to practice it for years. So, you know, this one time may have been that experience in which there was just a lot of suppressed tiredness. The system needed. Go on.
Well, I was going to ask you, did he do it wrong or do you want to risk your life by saying maybe Roy Keane is just not as hard as he thinks he is?
No, I've no idea. You know, look, I couldn't speculate as to, I know the practices he were doing were strong practices, you know, like he's made the comment that, you know, there being two types of yoga, one being kind of meditation and breathing and one being really strenuous, and he did the strenuous one. So it's not really a case of right or wrong. In fact, you know, if anything, I think the practice was probably doing its job, which is telling his system, relax, I'm not going to switch on for a while. I need you to rest. Mm. And that's probably what happened. The match came along and his system wasn't ready to kick in. Needed to rest more.
How many high-performance athletes include yoga as part of their regime?
Oh, listen, obviously I don't know that figure, but more and more and more. Like, I remember, like, even 15 years ago when I was teaching in the yoga room in Bulls Bridge, Rocky Elson used to come in and he'd do practices. He'd be in the back of the class and he'd be doing these incredible practices. So more and more, you know, like the Irish team would practice, Leinster team would practice, all the big rugby players would be practicing. And they, you know, you'd see that in the difference between the bodies of modern rugby players and rugby players of days gone by. You know, in the old days, forwards would go backwards and forwards. They didn't have the dexterity and the mobility that now rugby players are athletes. And a lot of that is down to yoga, is the mobility and the flexibility that system creates for people.
So there really isn't a body type that is necessarily suited to this, because we tend to think of yoga practitioners as being wiry and very light kind of people, maybe more scrum halves than prop forwards.
No, in a sense, you're grabbing the wrong end of the stick. You know, like people say, I don't do yoga because I'm not flexible. But that's the whole point to do it. Mm. Do you know that wherever you are on the spectrum, it's going to support you in joint mobility. It's going to, you know, in terms of the internal movement of the body, the endocrine system, the flow of blood through the system. All of that is supported by these yoga practices. So it is about longevity, particularly in terms of the joints, you know, and mobility as we get older. And Roy Keane himself has said that.
And Roy turned 50 this week. Should he keep it up? Is it a good age to start?
Well, it's not my job to tell anybody what they should do. But, you know, most of my clients are 50 and post 50. And, you know, I was with one client this morning. She turned 87 last week. So, and she does a practice. Every day she'll do her own practice and we see each other once a week. And she has, there's a quality of a spring chicken in her.
Yoga and meditation instructor Michael Ryan chatting to Phil about your haze on Today with Claire Byrne. The beaming faces of new parents Robbie Doyle and Laura Curtis graced the front page of the Irish Times today, newborn Demi in their arms. But the journey to this moment was anything but straightforward, as Laura told Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland.
And I tested positive on the Saturday, and by the Tuesday at midnight, I was taken by ambulance to Beaumont Hospital, where kind of day by day I started to deteriorate, and I was brought to ICU on the Saturday and put into the induced coma then on the Saturday for 17 nights. So 21 weeks pregnant then, going into ICU.
And when you went into, I mean, it's COVID, that journey for anyone and the whole of their health is terrifying enough. But from your point of view, your big concern wasn't yourself, it was your baby. What was that like in ICU, going under into a coma?
Yeah, so I didn't actually know at the time that I was going to be put into the induced coma. I didn't know that I was going to be put on a ventilator for how long or anything like that. So when I first got to the hospital, it was obviously very scary. Like, everything they were talking to me about and everything they wanted to do, x-rays, CT scans, I just kept referring to the baby. I said, no, I can't get them done. I can't take this. I can't take that because I'm pregnant. And I just kept kind of reiterating the point that, like, I don't want that to happen to the baby. And I kind of just didn't have a choice. I was so sick and I was deteriorating so fast that at that point, I didn't have a choice whether to worry about the pregnancy, really. It was more me fighting for my life.
And did you believe that they would be able to save you and the baby?
In the moment, I don't really know if I thought about it in the sense that she wouldn't have made it. I think I was more, like, I was so sick. You know, when you have the flu, nothing else, yeah, it really matters. Like, I kind of was just so sick at the time that although I was fighting for the baby and saying that I didn't want to take anything that would affect the baby, I don't think I really knew exactly what I was saying because I was so sick.
And then you were intubated, you were put into a coma. What happened when you woke up and you saw Robbie?
So 17 nights later, I woke up and obviously I was coming down off a really high dose of morphine. So I wasn't really with it a whole lot. So when I turned and he was sitting beside me, I thought I had just kind of gone asleep, or I was maybe asleep for a day or two. I didn't really have the concept of what had happened. So when I woke up, in my mind, I was having a great time. I was off on holidays and doing this, that and the other, because the morphine was so strong that I was having all these vivid dreams. They were good dreams, which was good. But I thought I was in Dubai and I was in Poland and I was having a great time. So when I woke up, I was telling him all these stories and he was just kind of going with it. And then I said to him, like, you do know I'm not pregnant anymore. And he said, no, Laura, like, you're still pregnant. And I said, no, like, the baby is gone. I'm not pregnant anymore, because that was the last conversation I had with the consultants in ICU. And that's when he played. He had a heartbeat sent to him on his WhatsApp from one of the doctors from the Rotunda that sent it to his phone. And he played it to me and he said, well, if you're not pregnant, whose heartbeat is on the phone? So, yeah, he kind of gave me a bit of reassurance then.
That must have been a magic moment.
Yeah, I don't know if I was really with it enough to realise.
Yeah, I know.
It was amazing that he had had that, and that for him, after 17 nights and during it, he had reassurance throughout as well, which was great.
Now, Demi was born on the 14th of July. And look, we until we all see and hold our babies, we all worry about them, don't we? And after everything you'd been through, you must have been anxious.
Oh, like, anxious isn't even the word. Like, I was in with the Rotunda every Thursday, and every Thursday I would hear her and I would see her. And then by Friday, I was kind of like waiting for the next Thursday. It was always a worry, like, is she really going to be okay after this? Is the birth going to be okay? Has she made it? Like, you know, there's still doubt, even though I could feel her kicking away and doing whatever. I definitely was still extremely worried until the day I had her in my arms, yeah.
Because you were going through, I mean, to continue with your pregnancy, which was great from your point of view, but you also had to cope with the whole post-COVID, recovering from being in ICU, and that wasn't easy, was it?
Yeah, and that's the thing I kind of struggled with, because people would link in with me, like the physio from Beaumont and some of the teams in the Rotunda, and they would say, how are you feeling? And I kind of couldn't differentiate between what was post-COVID and what was pregnancy, because mm-hmm. I had never been this far in pregnancy. So the not being able to walk too well, the pressure on my lungs, the out of breath, like all of that is coming with pregnancy and COVID. It was just obviously more extreme for me, because when I had first came out, I really struggled because I wouldn't have had any energy at all. And my bump was obviously grown and I was getting more and more pregnant. So I was again trying to fight for her and, mm-hmm. and eat well for her and do everything I could for her. But I was struggling, you know.
And there's been so much tragedy around COVID. And I know in terms of your own family, your nanny, unfortunately, lost her life as well when she had COVID. It's just so marvellous, you know. And again, looking at the picture of you holding Demi, she just looks absolutely gorgeous and bonny. And she's 4 weeks old now. Is that right?
Yeah, she was 4 weeks yesterday. Yeah, thanks so much. She's doing great now, I have to say. There's not a bother on her. She's living her best life. She hasn't a clue what we've both been through. So she's having a great time. Little does she know when I show her the front of the Irish Times in a couple of years.
And I know you want to say finally the importance that your thanks to the staff of the Beaumont Hospital and the Rotunda.
Yeah, I suppose that was my main reason in getting the story out there, was just, you know, you hear different stories that people are giving out about this, that and the other in relation to COVID, and it's obviously the hot topic at the moment. And I just want to give them the praise that they deserve, because it's very hard. Like, it's very hard for them. And I've seen, like, I was in hospital for 5 weeks. I see what they have to go through, the slog they have to go through for 12 hours a day, and just the care they gave for me, both the Rotunda and Beaumont, like, we wouldn't be here today. So yeah, it's just to highlight the greatness they do and the gratitude I have towards them for saving both of our lives.
Laura Curtis chatting to Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland. And parenting doesn't get any easier. On The Ray D'Arcy Show, child and adolescent psychoanalyst Dr. Coleman Nochter answered listeners' questions.
My daughter is 13 years old and has started talking about how she is a lesbian. This came about when she started asking questions about whether certain relatives were supportive of LGBT people. My wife and I are both supportive of who she's going to be. However, she's eager to tell friends and family, etc. And we also feel 13 is too young to start defining and declaring a sexual identity. Part of it is that she's had interest in boys previously, so we want to spare her from defining herself as the lesbian and then possibly regretting that later. Part of it is that despite kids and society probably being more supportive these days, we think that she's a bit naive and doesn't understand some of the ugliest she might be exposed to. And part of it is that we just don't think it's anyone's business how a 13-year-old is sexually identifying. The thing we're having trouble with is how to communicate you shouldn't take this public now and make sure it doesn't come across as this is something you should be ashamed of. Do you have any tips? Are we completely wrong in our approach?
No, is the first answer. Right, this is really tricky. This is
really
very
tricky.
Very little changes in mental health, but this is a conversation that has changed dramatically in terms of, if you go back 15, 20 years, parents coming with this worry versus now. And the first thing is, this 13-year-old girl told you she was having these feelings. So right off the bat,
that's
brilliant.
Great.
Fantastic. Yes. So she must have felt safe enough to have that conversation. The issue is, you know, we want to strike that balance between we support you, but we don't know whether the world is in a place that's ready for you yet. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view of, it's not, we're not concerned about you, but we're concerned about how other people will react to that. And there is a kind of, you're either with us or without, you know, you're for me or against me for young people around this time. And it's oftentimes important for parents to say, look, you've known this for a while, but this is new to us. So we have to get our heads around trying to help you with it and support you with it. The issue around going public, I mean, she's 13 years of age, so I don't know how public she intends on going, but it's many times that the publication piece is to see if the approval, if there is approval in wider circles. It might be to aunts or grannies, and oftentimes young people will go to the person who they think is most conservative to try and suss out how they would react, because it kind of tests the water in that regard. The issue here is completely support her to be who she is and who she wants to be. But you can do that with caution. And you're saying that it's not about anything to do with shame or anything to do with, but it's just that these things can, you know, in terms of can we ever have a defined definiteness around sexuality? And can we have that at 13? Maybe not. And maybe that changes. But if it changes, so what? You know, yeah. From the point of view of supporting her for where she's at the moment. Sometimes it can be a difficult conversation for parents. If there is an uncle, a cousin or an aunt or something who has a good relationship with her, it sometimes feels less confrontational if it's not your parents, because it's just trying to suss out how, you know, how are you at the moment? What are things? What's going on for you? And trying to help her to work it out.
And when you think back to those teenage years, like, you know, all about experimenting and living and all of those things, you know, defining yourself so early is, you know, it's that's what we do as teenagers, isn't it? We kind of want to go out and explore and experiment and...
Yeah, and look, identity, we try them on like coats and
exactly,
jackets, you know,
yeah.
And but it, from the point of view of, it, because it's the sexuality piece, it has to be just done with a degree of...
For sure.
Discretion and obviously that you're not... And they're conscious of her believing that there's a shame element. I'd be fairly confident that she doesn't feel that. If she can come to you, and the way that even the way that email is written, it would suggest that that isn't a question. But helping her to journey with her, with it, would be no harm.
Okay. What's Coleman's definition of a good holiday with teens? ? How does a parent whose relationship with their kids that normally ends in slam doors survive a week-long holiday that we'll both enjoy? Any tips on advice on how to holiday with teens and tweens?
Separately. Yeah. I think from the
only
point
one of you will enjoy it.
The issue is, I mean, you can't be all things to all people, you know, and what parents might enjoy in terms of a holiday versus what teenagers will enjoy will be a different experience. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be moments in the holiday that, and a holiday is about moments, you know, it's not about a sustained week of
bliss.
It's not. It's the moments where you got caught out in the rain under the thing and someone stood in a puddle or whatever it might be. Or it might be that laugh around the table when we were out for dinner, whatever it might be. And it's the moments that make it. But if you're trying to set it as perfect, I keep saying this all the time, perfection is the enemy of the good. If you want this to be perfect and you're going in, nobody's going to have a grumpy face. Nobody's going to be on their devices. We're going to have the most wonderful, you know, Brady Bunch family you've ever seen. It's not going to work that way, and you're going to be disappointed. Just look for the moments. And if there are a handful of moments, that's all we remember from holidays, are moments anyway. We don't remember every minute of every day. But just if we can make, I think a successful holiday is more good moments than bad ones. But be aware you'll have both, because it's a tricky thing to negotiate.
Yeah, and I'd also from the outset really look at, I mean, if you want to have a good time yourself, it's really about making them have a good time. Not making them, but setting it up so they possibly will. So making it, for me, it's really looking at what they want to do, keeping them active, you know, and really kind of looking at the type of holiday that's going to make them happy, because then it will kind of make your holiday happier.
I'm always reminded of Billy Connolly when he said he took his kids to Scotland and he showed them all the mountains and he said to them, what was their favourite part of the holiday? And they said, Sesame Street. It was the video they were watching in the car. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, we can say to children, you know, mountains and lakes in that order are nice, but that's not what they see. And it's so it is, you're absolutely right. If they're enjoying themselves, you will by default enjoy it off them.
Totally.
But again, it's moments. And not a sustained 7 days of bliss.
Yeah,
I think that's probably unrealistic.
That's great advice. Okay, my 14-year-old son's phone broke a few days ago, and the other night when I had already fallen asleep, he used my phone to play games. My husband, who has been gone on business for a couple of days, sent me some naughty texts during that time window. I know my son saw these messages because he blocked his dad. He has barely spoken to me in 2 days. I'm embarrassed and I'm not sure what to say to him. My husband just says let it go, that he'll get over it soon, but what if he's not, or am I overreacting? Oh God, that's awful.
I think you might have had an item or have an item about children on their phones, you know, getting your adult's phone. Your phone is your diary.
Yes.
You do not, you know, we've all had that. We're showing someone a picture and somebody scrolls to the next. And, and it's like me coming up to a guard at checkpoint. I've done nothing wrong, but I feel anxious anyway.
Do you know what I mean? Going through airport security.
So the first thing is you have to be really conscious that your phone is your phone and your child shouldn't have your phone. They certainly shouldn't have passwords to it. But look, what's done is done. The issue here is that, you know, you have to, I think you have to address it with the child and say, look, but I wouldn't, I mean, you've seen something that wasn't meant for you. Is as much as the conversation needs to be. Do you know what I mean? That they accessed the phone without your permission, they saw something. I don't think you have to go into the intimacies of your own relationship or anything like it. But just to name it is probably enough at this point to say, look, let's, you know, because if it's the elephant in the room and no one's talking about it, then everyone's kind of uncomfortable and conscious. Do they know? How much do they know? All that sort of stuff. Be the adult in the room and own it and say, look, this is something that it wasn't meant for your eyes or ears, but you did see it. And, you know, that's part of an adult relationship that you'll find out about in time. So I wouldn't labour it, I'd just acknowledge it.
Okay.
But pretending it didn't happen and maybe dad's kicking the can down the road and forget about it, I wouldn't go with that approach either, because then it festers. Do you know what I mean? So just demystify the embarrassment of it. It is an embarrassing situation. This is, you know...
And is it as simple as that? Like just saying, listen, you shouldn't have seen it and you'll learn all about it in the future, and or do you do the, does the child need to have more of a conversation about it?
This is his parents. You know, this is their relationship. It's a different dynamic than explaining the non-reality of pornography or something like that. Do you know what I mean? There's a different relationship here. So that conversation can happen in a parallel process around, you know, what's right and wrong or what intimacy is or any of those sorts of things. I wouldn't get that into that with this. But I would give him an opportunity to say, we know it, it's, you know, we can't unsee something. But if we unspeak about what we see, it can make it a lot worse.
Should she wait till her husband gets home?
Again, up to them. I mean, it depends how she thinks dad will manage this. And I wouldn't like the whole nobody's talking to each other and everyone's looking.
Deal with it straight on and upfront.
Yeah, the longer it goes on, the more uncomfortable the conversation's going to be.
Okay, I think we have time for one more quickly. I have a 16-year-old going into TY year. He's withdrawn into himself over the last year and given up on his sporting activities. It's like he's lost his spark or zest for life. How can I support him through adolescence, but at the same time try to spur him on to look forward to a new year in school and new challenges? Do 16-year-olds come out of this fog?
See, the fog is COVID related. You know, you can't separate this fog from the 18 months that we've been through. Do you know what I mean? So what I would see a lot in this is young people who have become fatalistic about reopenings and closings and reopenings and closings. They don't trust them. Do you know what I mean? They don't trust that September time there isn't going to be another surge and everything's going to be pulled again. And so they're reluctant to get engaged meaningfully in stuff at the moment, because they went off for 2 weeks in March, didn't get back for 6 months. They went off for Christmas holidays, they didn't get back for 4 months, you know. So their trust in the system has been really jolted from that point of view. And their lack of interest or apathy can be just, they don't want to be disappointed again. So in terms of, does he lift the fog lift? Let's hope we get to October, November, no more surges, no more closures of schools. Let's keep things momentum going. And then he'll have a corrective emotional experience where he'll be able to trust in engaging whatever activity is happening. But it's going to take him time. But just encourage him and support him without nagging him about it, because it could be an anxiety as opposed to a reluctance. But we've all gotten into bad habits, Catherine. You know, we've spending more time on screens than outside, all that sort of stuff. And it's going to take a while.
Yeah, and it's a reminder of how important exercise and being outdoors is for not just teenagers, but for all of us, you know, for our mental health.
And I think people are kind of saying, oh, we're out of it now. We're not. No. I mean, we're psychologically and emotionally, we're still trudging through we're still recalibrating.
Coleman Nochter, talking to Catherine Thomas. So, how prepared are we for when our social lives take off again? We've heard Lady Gaga's post-pandemic party plans.
No sleep. Bus. Club. Another club. Another club. Another club. Plane. Next place. No sleep. Another club.
But not everyone shares her enthusiasm, as Barry Lenihan heard.
That was very good. It's a bit weird. Lost all my social skills over the last 2 years, but it's interesting getting back and talking to people again.
And is it more tiring than before? Some people are saying they're finding the whole thing exhausting, catching up with everyone.
Yeah, sort of like starting a new job. There's loads of new input everywhere. We've kind of got used to a quiet life over the last 2 years.
And small talk harder than before?
Definitely, yeah. Used to a lot more quiet time.
We've come up from Monaghan. Three sisters. One from Florida, Carrickmacross and Carrickmacross.
And is it different to before, or is it more stressful organising things and all that?
Well, a little bit more stressful, yeah. What to do with the mask and that, and every store you go into you have to wear the mask. It's a wee bit more, you're more careful, I guess, more careful.
And what's it like to see her all the way back from Florida?
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. See her after 3 years. Last time I seen was Hurricane Michael. I was over in America.
How did you survive that?
Six bottles of wine later, I wasn't more.
I think there is a certain amount of social readjustment, whereas there's a very obvious departure from what we were in, where for about a year and a half we were stuck inside and mostly communicating online. And it is exhausting because everybody wants to do something every week. That's hard to keep up with, but it's like, there's no problem with pacing yourself, you know? People are just finding it hard to readjust after being alone for so long. I was affected really negatively because I'm a very social person, so when everything closed down, I was just in a bad headspace.
A bit nervous, I suppose, sometimes still about reintegrating in, but
it's what life's about. We're social creatures. We need to be around each other, and that's what's natural. It's unnatural to be so indoors and isolated.
Poor more COVID. Annoying that you have to book everything in advance, because
it's not the same with any live music.
You know? And you can only sit with five of your friends as opposed
it's a more
well, it's six at a table.
Definitely.
Is that stressful to pick who you have to sit beside?
Yeah, well, yeah, you need to
shout out to all the girls at home that can
come the rebels!
So that's
like, we had to book everything for coming up here.
I booked everything two months in advance.
You see my itinerary. I'm so stressed, guys. Like, honestly.
I just feel like we're constantly on like a time schedule.
Yeah,
we can't enjoy anything because you're like, oh, we've got it six, we have to be here.
Yeah.
Well, happy birthday.
Happy birthday!
Up the rebels!
What was advice to ease us into post-pandemic socialising, Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke to Dr. Sabina Brennan, health psychologist, neuroscientist and host of the Super Brain podcast.
The brain is built for change and it adapts. And that's how, you know, how we have survived as a species, but also how we've adapted to lockdown. You know, our brain has learned how to, okay, this is our new normal. I don't go out. I don't shake hands with people. I don't do all. So we've relearned all that. That was really challenging at the start of lockdown. But then a lot of us have got used to it. And for a lot of us, it's become kind of comfortable in a way. And so now we've got to face a new challenge. But rather than the first challenge was imposed on us, and we had to learn, you know, we have to do this, we have to isolate. This challenge, we have more freedom, things are opened up, so we have a choice. And the thing is, you know, there could be a tendency to not reintegrate, and that's not a good idea. It's understandable, but it's not a good idea. As one of the people on your Vox Pop, and actually they all said very astute things, you know, we are social creatures and we need social interaction. People with more social ties live longer, they've better health, they're less depressed, they've less cognitive impairment, they're less likely to develop dementia. Social engagement, social interaction is vital for our mental, physical and our brain health. So we have to kind of make that effort. So we kind of have to push ourselves if we're feeling a bit reticent, but at our own pace.
We have to almost think of socialising as a muscle that needs exercise. I know I certainly found it the case that when I first started meeting people after coming out of lockdown, I couldn't talk. All the words were coming out backwards and I had forgotten the basic kind of things about how to interact with people because I hadn't been using that muscle.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not that you'll have forgotten totally. It's that you're rusty. So a lot of that stuff, you know, before lockdown was very habitual. How's it going? What did you hear the match? And you're in tune with what... you know, different people talk about, oh, he loves Ga, you know, she likes such and such, you know, and you have your little sort of repertoire of things that you can kind of draw on. So you haven't used that for a while. Now, it won't have disappeared completely. But I think it's a bit like if you think about, you know, say you're a runner or some sort of sports person and you've had an injury and, you know, or you've just had to stop for some reason, you know, you become deconditioned. You know, it's a bit the same, but that doesn't mean you'll never be able to run again. So basically what you've got to do is you don't go straight out just because you used to run 10K and say, oh, I'm going to run 10K. You kind of do it a bit at a time. And I think we all need to understand different people's needs in that regard. I am very conscious that some people who may already have had social anxiety before lockdown, who've dealt with that and done work on it and been able to engage socially, then they're actually told to avoid people, which is, you know, what was sort of something they were trying to overcome before lockdown. I'm kind of concerned for some of those people that might be finding it extremely challenging.
And for people who weren't necessarily particularly anxious beforehand, is it normal now? Because this is certainly something that's coming in on the text and it's been something that's been observed to me, that we find ourselves looking at other people and scrutinising their activities and making judgments about whether they're observing social distancing or not and getting quite anxious about it in a way that we never would have cared at all what the people at the table next to us were doing in the past.
Yeah, we never would have noticed them. We would have been engaged in, you know, our own company, our own behaviour. You might notice if someone did something really randomly out of the ordinary. But I mean, I went out for my first meal a couple of weeks ago and I was so conscious when people got up to walk around, they didn't have their masks on. I wanted to say, you know, put your mask on, you know. I mean, that's okay. You know, your brain is protecting you. It's looking out for signals of danger. Our brain does that all the time anyway, you know, loud noises, a car coming up. Do you know what I mean? Or footsteps behind you walking along a dark street, you'll go on high alert. We've learned that there are new things that we need to be alert to. So our brain is just kind of protecting us. I don't know, I think that's something that we can acknowledge and decide whether to take action. You know, say call a waiter over and say, actually, these people here, you may not have noticed, or to ignore it. You know, it's about assessing the risk. But one is unconscious. So the fear, that the anxiety, that heightened sense is unconscious. But you can engage your frontal lobes, which is your conscious brain, and go, OK, is it realistic to be afraid of this, or am I actually being over the top?
And it is also perfectly polite to point out to somebody that their mask has slipped down onto their chin and over, not up over their nose and mouth. There is nothing wrong with that whatsoever. The exhausting thing here is, though, now trying to fit everybody in, because every single person you meet, you're conscious of the fact that you haven't seen them in a year and a half. But you know what? You might not have seen them in a year and a half without a pandemic anyway.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's, like I said, you know, everybody will want to do this at different paces, you know, and that's because from a social loneliness and social isolation, you know, our sense of loneliness is very individual. So really what it is when there's a disconnect between your social needs and the amount of social contact you have. And that's different for absolutely everybody. You might need to see, you know, somebody every single day. I might be okay actually with once every 2 or 3 weeks. So it's where there's a mismatch. And I think where we'll have problems is that some people will have a backlog of loads of people, but they've actually decided over the pandemic, actually, I don't need to socialise as much and I'd like to prioritise my family and spend more time with them. And then you'll have people at the other extreme who are dying to see people, and the people they want to see don't particularly want to see them. I would say don't take any of that personally. You know, just kind of acknowledge that everybody's going to do this in their own pace. But if you do feel lonely, it's important to reconnect and maybe look at new ways to do that.
And to what extent is it possibly the case that brain fog is not just a symptom of COVID, but also a symptom of social isolation, and that people shouldn't be worried if their brains are not working at optimum?
Look, absolutely. And I was actually writing my book Beating Brain Fog at the start of the pandemic, you know, and I was writing it in various contexts. You know, it's associated with autoimmune diseases, it's associated with viral illnesses. That's what we're seeing with long COVID. It's associated with sepsis, hormonal changes, various other things. But it is also associated with lifestyle factors, many of which were shifted towards the direction that would give rise to brain fog. So poor sleep. A lot of us had very disrupted sleep. Poorly managed chronic stress. A lot of us have been chronically stressed. Some people have been managing it better than others. A lack of routine, I think, is a big thing that actually happened in terms of the pandemic. Yeah. Because pre-pandemic, 40% of our behaviours are automated. And that frees up your thinking brain to engage in the complex activities of your work. And a lot of us lost our routines during the pandemic.
So it's all right to be sluggish. It's all right to be finding yourself in a room and not remembering what it is that had brought you in there in the first place.
What I would say is it is understandable, but you do need to look at certain lifestyle factors. Okay. So sleep, stress, you know, isolation, getting connected will help as well.
Dr. Sabina Brennan, health psychologist, neuroscientist and host of the Superbrain podcast, chatting to Philip Boucher Hayes on Today with Claire Byrne. While out and about on his holidays, bibliophile Ryan Tuberty sniffed out a corner of Connemara that was right up his street. Letterfrack, already renowned for its furniture design college and various hostelries, is also the proud home of a community-based bookshop. And this morning, Joanne Hunter described the bookshop and its origins.
Books at One in Letterfrack is the second member of the Books at One family, and it's part of a not-for-profit organisation that's bringing bookshops to places like Letterfreck, places of rural isolation or socially disadvantaged areas,
yeah.
places where you're not going to find a normal commercial bookshop. And it came from an idea by Declan Ryan of the One Foundation. He set up a community bookshop with the local community in Lewisburg a number of years ago. And that was so successful that there was a call out for other people who may be interested in bringing these community bookshops to their area. And Marian Vincent and Letterfreck were one of those groups of people that got in touch. And that's how Books at One and Letterfreck came about.
So the, in both cases, people, Declan Ryan, who philanthropically comes up with the money to what, fund a building or something like that?
So in the case of Lewisburg, Declan bought that building. He could see the dereliction, you know, that was coming into rural Ireland at the time following the recession. And he just wanted to do something for Lewisburg because he had holidayed there, you know, throughout his life. And he loves books, like yourself and like me. And bookshop was kind of a natural fit. And yeah, he did supply the funding to set up Books at One in Lewisburg and Letterfreck. But I suppose what we want to do now is to spread the story and get other people on board so that we can bring this wonderful concept to every county in Ireland.
And the idea is to open, I'm echoing what I'm hearing, but to open a bookshop in towns or villages around the country that simply don't have a bookshop, but also the bookshop serves as much more than that. When you think of post offices closing and places that would have been traditional meeting points, this maybe fills that void.
Absolutely. We see the bookshop as not just a place where it's a transaction where a customer comes in and buys a book, and we see it more as a community hub.
Yeah.
So it's a very kind of democratic space where people of all ages and all backgrounds can get together through a common interest in reading and in books. And I suppose we like to refer to our bookshops as the third space, you know, somewhere outside of home and school for kids, or outside of home and work for adults, yeah. where they can feel comfortable and connected, you know, much the same way as you would in a sporting club. So the way I look at it, my family are really into sport,
okay.
and I'm the oddity that I'm into books. So I see these bookshops like as the hurling pitch for book lovers.
Oh, well, that's a really nice way of putting it.
Yeah, that's the idea that we want to get out there, that it's for everybody. And it's a lovely place for people to connect. You know, you could have an 11-year-old recommending a book to a 60-year-old or vice versa.
Yeah.
And then we have a lot of other activities in the bookshops as well, in what we are referring to now as normal times. We have story time on Saturday morning. We have two book clubs. And in fact, the people who run the book clubs have keys to the bookshop in Lewisburg. So what better place to go on a dreary winter?
Yeah. I'm already there already in my mind, which is great. But your background isn't books, is it?
No.
How did you get the calling to this world?
Okay. So it's a long story, and I'll give you the short version.
Sounds good.
So I was happily working in a golf club for about 13 years, and I came across an article in a newspaper about Books at One in Lewisburg. And as I was reading this article, my phone pinged twice. My sister and a former colleague sent this article to me and said, "Joanne, have you seen this?" So I was reading about this wonderful community bookshop, and I was just blown away by the idea. And I just said, you know, this is brilliant, it's crazy, and I have to be part of it. So I got on the phone, rang the bookshop in Lewisburg, and a week later hopped into my car, went up to Mayo and met the people there. And to be honest with you, Ryan, I've hardly thought about anything else since that day. So then...
What were you doing in the golf club?
I was managing a rural golf club. I live in rural Ireland in a place called Kildare in County Cork, which is kind of a poster boy for rural development.
Yes.
And I would see prior to that, I had worked in a small rural food business. And prior to that, again, I qualified as an accountant. That's my dark history.
Dark history. Yeah. We're a deep dive. I love that you have the strain of thought that continues throughout the thread is rural development and community. So this was your road to demand. It was like a lightning bolt, your friends pinging you on the phone to say, "This is it. This is your moment almost."
Absolutely.
So you went to Lewisburg.
Yeah.
You went to the well. What did you find there?
Well, I found a lovely bookshop, lovely people, you know, a buzz around books that you wouldn't see in a normal commercial bookshop. You know, that it was books were a way of connecting people. And I really got that concept and I said, like, I need to do this. You know, I really need to get involved in this. I always had this kind of vague dream that I'd like to have a bookshop because I grew up in Listowel in County Kerry.
Oh, come on. How many bookshops do they have?
Yeah. So, like, there was three bookshops there at one stage and we have a massive library, yeah. Writers Week and all the activity and the excitement, all the competitions around that. And in school, I had really good teachers as well. It was a bit, you know, Dead Poet Society in my memory anyway. Maybe not at the time.
No, it's okay to have lovely literary dreams like that. Go on. Yeah.
So I always had this vague dream that, you know, I'd love to have a bookshop. And a lot of people have that, I suppose, without realising all the hard work and the investment that goes behind it.
Well pointed out, yes.
Yeah. So I had that vague dream, but now I'm in a position where I'm working with all these really, you know, visionary people that have that same dream as me. And I hope to be in a position to bring these bookshops to other communities around Ireland.
So did you leave the golf club to join this?
Yeah.
How did they find you, or did you say to them?
Oh, I just
made your presence felt, shall we say?
Yeah, so I managed to persuade the manager in Lewisburg to pass my details to the people in Dublin who were, you know, driving the project at the time.
Okay.
And that led to a meeting and then it led to various discussions and I just put myself forward. The opening came up for someone to drive the project from a head office perspective. So I just put myself forward, said, give me the job, let me try this out and see how we go. And I suppose the rest is history. Here
that's
I am.
Great.
Here
so,
I am. Yeah.
So, well, they struck gold when they found you. That's really lovely. And what is your role now in
so,
all of this?
So my role is general manager. So I suppose I have oversight of the shop in Lewisburg. I work very closely with Mary and Vincent and all the team to get Letterfrack up and running. And we managed to open Letterfrack in December of 2020. Despite COVID, it all came in more or less on time.
And the building in Letterfrack, because I haven't been to the Lewisburg one, but it struck me as being like, I think Mary was saying, it was an old cottage from the grounds. I think even a Quaker cottage, she mentioned to me over coffee. And I was struck by how welcoming, because a bookshop has to have a vibe. And this one has a very warm, welcoming vibe.
Yeah. So I think that's a combination of the building and the people.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Yeah, and kind of pride of place as well, you know, that Mary and Vincent really, this is what they want to do and they want to do it there. So, and I think it's, you know, the history of it, the Quaker history, you know, is continuing now, you know, I think in that building, that it's a place, you know, where, okay, backed by philanthropy, but it's a place where local people are doing something good for their community.
Yeah. And so there's an echo of history in there.
There is, yeah. I think it's in the walls. And it previously was a forge and, you know, that was another gathering place for people, I suppose, in rural Ireland long ago. Yeah. So, and there was Mary and Vincent have their own publishing business as well. So they were working from that premises. And it's in a row of workshops where there are other craftspeople as well. So there's a lovely community vibe there.
Definitely.
And the youth reach are next door. There's a library and a community radio in that little area as well. Yeah,
so. Yes, I was passing, they were doing a radio program, the window opened, so I was kind of listening to the radio through the window as opposed to on the radio. So it's kind of, but it's gorgeous, and they have Ernest Shackleton's cabin has been worked on in one of the warehouses there as well. So it's a busy place. My question to you then ultimately is, for now, if somebody was listening this morning saying, God, I live in a village, there's no bookshop, or I'd love to do this, how can they get involved? Or maybe a sponsor, for example, a big business would say, well, how can we do something for a local town or village?
Yeah, so I suppose what we need people and we need property and we need financial support. They're the three things that are needed for a bookshop. So if somebody is listening and they have a building that would be suitable for use as a bookshop and they want to run a bookshop, they can get in touch through our website, booksat1.ie.
Okay.
And if somebody wants to support us financially, they can get in touch. So it is that combination. We need the people in the community to drive this. We need a property and these bookshops need support over the initial period. But the idea is that they're a social enterprise. So after the initial period, that will be a very self-sustaining business and it will be a community hub. And like, I'm adamant that these are going to be, you know, a consistent part of rural or small town life for decades, if not generations to come.
Here's hoping. Would you love to own one yourself or run one yourself?
That was my original plan.
Yeah. Where would you put it?
I suppose in Kildare in County Cork, where I live, it's my second home.
Okay.
Yeah. We've a great community spirit there and we've a great, you know, interest in sports. We've historical society, community garden. We don't have anything around books. And I suppose coming from Listowel, I didn't realise that other people didn't have this. You know, I assumed that everybody was comfortable, you know, trying to write a poem or going to a play or picking up a book and, you know, feeling a personal connection nearly with the author. Yeah. And it wasn't until I moved from home that I realised not everyone has that. And I would love to be able to give that to the, say, the kids growing up in Kildare now.
It'd be lovely for them to have that. Let's go to Lewisburg, actually, and we'll speak to Greg Fletcher, who's running the Books at One shop there. Good morning, Greg. Nice to talk to you.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
I'm very well, indeed. You're from Perth originally, is that right?
From Perth in Western Australia, that's correct. So a long way from home.
Tell me, how do we go from Perth to Lewisburg? What happened?
Well, I met a girl, first of all, Ryan. That was the main thing.
So, of course.
My lovely wife, Georgina, is from County Mayo. So we moved back from Australia a couple of years ago now. And I just managed to stumble across this advert for a manager for the Lewisburg shop and started last year, was hired last year. So.
And I presume you've been listening to Joanne describing the concept. How does it work in practice, for example, in Lewisburg? Do people use the shop and do they visit the shop? Do they love the being surrounded by the beautiful books? I mean, what's the modus operandi for you there?
Well, look, the Lewisburg people are very generous, they love the bookshop, they love the concept, and so they're very giving to the shop, and I think what we try and do is kind of service that community by offering this, but they have to embrace it as well, and so you know they like to, you know, well, first off, spend here, but then also use those other activities and projects that we do and offer for them as well, you know.
And you have this very unusual bench outside the shop that is it.
The bench, yeah. So the bench was actually our illustrious leader, Declan, came across an image of this bench, and kind of what we did was get the Lewisburg Men's Shed involved to kind of source it, find it, and then put it together for us, basically. And the writing's on the bench. It's a book that's folded out that you sit on. But they sourced some material from local people. There's stories about Lewisburg, actually, on the benches themselves. And so it's kind of a nice touch for the community. And, it's very eye-catching. So people actually driving through the town actually stop to look at the benches and then realise there's a bookshop behind it as well, you know. So.
And, Greg, you know, I was at the opticians yesterday and I was just making an appointment for an eye test, which I recommend everyone do 2 years later, you know yourself. Anyway, as I was coming out, there was a lady coming in and she was kind of grappling with the door and her dog in the lead. And I said, what are you going to do with your dog? She goes, and she felt she'd found a pole to, and it looked a bit scrappy, but she got there eventually. No such problems for you, Greg.
No such problems for us. No, we have a dog parking zone at the front and with the bench, obviously you can sit with your dog. Look, we actually have a courtyard out the back of the shop as well. We're kind of, the Lewisburg shop here is quite large, so we've got a lot of space. So, you know, you can park your dog out the front in the dog parking zone, or, you know, even if they're getting a bit noisy, you can bring them out the back into the garden as well. So, dog friendly here.
I want to ask you a question before we go, which is relating to wedding planning, as mentioned earlier on in the programme today. You got married where?
On the top of Crow Patrick. So 11 years ago this month, actually. Yeah.
And
so,
did you have any guests at your wedding at the top of Crow Patrick?
Did I have any guests?
Yes.
I had 60 people climbed up with us. We had another 60 waiting at the bottom for us to return. So, yeah, plus a few other tourists. There's a lot of people in the wedding video who I don't know. So there's plenty of people that were up there with us. So, yeah, it was a great day.
Well, from my experience of Crow Patrick, the something blue would have been most of the guests' lips and other extremities. Greg Fletcher and Joanne Hunter chatting about Books at One on The Ryan Tubridy Show. And that's all I can fit in today. Thanks for listening.